Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Jim Shepherd's new book, The Book of Aaron, tells the story of a Jewish boy growing up in poverty and desperation. It begins before the Germans invaded Poland, and through Aaron's eyes takes us from the Polish countryside into the depths of the Warsaw Ghetto, and then into a famous orphanage for destitute children. Shepherd is the author of 6 previous novels and 4 story collections, including Like You'd Understand Anyway, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the Story Prize. He teaches at Williams College, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jim Shepherd back to the book show. Thank you very much for being here. Great pleasure, as always.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to this particular subject and this particular boy?
Well, you know, I was always drawn, as we've talked about in the past, to catastrophe as a subject and to man-made catastrophe because of our complicity with our own disasters. And if you're drawn to man-made catastrophe, you come around to the Holocaust pretty quickly as a subject. And so I read about the Holocaust quite a bit as a boy and never thought I would write about it, although I did think I would keep reading about it. And maybe 5 years ago, an old student of mine sent me an email saying, "Why have you never written about Janusz Korczak?" And I wrote him back and said, "Well, because I've always been wary about writing about the great men of history. I prefer the worm's eye view, and I'm always a little leery about trying to get into what you might call leadership studies or something like that. And I'm also even more leery about writing about saintly figures, because I always find myself thinking, well, what conflicts are supposed to be commensurate with their saintliness? You know, Gandhi has a stutter, or Jesus doesn't get along with women, or something like that. But I am a weird enough person that I own Korczak's Ghetto Diary, and I thought, well, I'll read it again just to check it out again. And rereading it, came across a story he tells of a boy whose mother whose mother was dying, but said to him, "I will stay alive as long as it takes to get you into that orphanage." And the orphanage that Korczak ran in the ghetto was very difficult to get into because obviously everybody wanted to be in it. And the mother miraculously stayed alive for month after month until an opening appeared. Korczak told her about the opening. She said, "Thank God," put the boy in the orphanage and died. And the boy was then inconsolable. And it suddenly struck me, what would that be like to be unable to appreciate a saintly figure, to know that you're in the presence of someone who's an amazing human being who saved your life and is continuing to save your life, and yet because of the damage you've already sustained, you can't really bring yourself to appreciate it? That additional psychic internal pressure seemed fascinating to me. It seemed like something I could access emotionally, and it also seemed like a new way into the subject.
And of course, before we get to that point, we learn a lot about Aaron,
right,
which is the gateway to having us understand how he reacts to that saintly mm-hmm. figure. How would you describe Aaron?
One of the things that I became fascinated with once I started reading children's narratives from Poland in the 30s, 20s and 30s, was how much grinding poverty most Jewish children lived under, because, of course, Jews were denied so many careers. And it suddenly struck me that that Edenic and slightly romantic model that you see in a kind of Holocaust fiction or film, you know, things were wonderful and we were all holding hands around the table until the Germans walked in, was something that was really only true of the upper and middle classes, and even there, not most of the time. And so I liked the idea that I would be dramatizing a child who's life was pretty miserable before the Germans arrived, essentially, so that's yet one more thing as opposed to the beginning of the end of Eden kind of thing.
And here is a kid who is very much a kid. He doesn't really listen to his parents. Mm-hmm. He has problems in school, and he says mean things about people who are infirmed and so forth. so he in many ways is, as I said, a normal kid, but also is not the nicest of children.
Right. I've always been interested throughout my writing career in the ways in which we internalize others' judgments, especially young people internalize judgments. And we find ourselves just saying, because the nuns used to do this with my school all the time. They used to say, you know, Joe, I expected that of Jim, but I thought you were better than that, you know, and that yeah. whole sense that you had already been identified as a good or a bad child was something I grew up with and was fascinated by and internalized as well. And I'm very interested in the way Aaron can simultaneously disappoint the reader because he is just a regular kid and he's getting hardened as he goes along. But he also can strike the reader as someone who's being way too hard on himself, you know, and has just assumed, as everybody else has, that I guess I'm never going to amount to anything. I guess I'm a bad child, that kind of thing.
Because there is that strain, but there's also the great honesty that he has about himself. And it's the honesty that he has in describing the horrific nature of mm-hmm. what is around him.
And I think you respond to, or at least I respond to, that perception he has, however dim, of the gap between who he is most of the time and who he would like to be. So that sense that he may not be demonstrating compassion when he's describing something is doubled by this other sense that he would like to be able to demonstrate compassion. And he's trying to figure out how compassion operates and how empathy operates. And that tension operates, I think, throughout the novel and, of course, is part of what Korczak is intended to galvanize when he finally shows up.
Certainly, I don't want you to get away without answering the question, which is...
You don't want me to get away without answering any question.
Well, that's true. I guess that is my job, isn't it? But as far as that interest in catastrophe, do you know where that comes from?
That's a good question. I mean, some part of it is the... undeveloped 10-year-old inside me who just is fascinated by the notion of things going boom. But some of it, too, I think, is a registration of the way in which loss ramifies outward. I mean, I think if loss is the sort of seminar that we're all going to be enrolled in at some point or another, catastrophe is sort of group loss. It's a sort of spectacle of loss on a larger scale. And one of the things that has struck me over the years is because I've been so fascinated by our inability to completely grapple with oncoming catastrophe, I've gone from being a faintly worrisome fringe figure to somebody who looks like he just reads the papers. Because
good point. So is the in the writing of the story, I sensed in your earlier description that there may have been some hesitation in telling a story like this, in for want of a better term, that there was concern that you could pull it off.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's concern in my case that I can pull anything off. And I seem to be always beginning a project and then thinking to myself, really, are you going to really do this? Are you going to try and do this? But in some ways, I'm helpless in the face of, well, this is the only thing right now that I want to be doing that doesn't seem to me utterly lame. And so at some point or another with a project like this, I will say, well, look, you're pleasing yourself at least as you move forward. You're keeping yourself interested. And if it doesn't amount to anything, it doesn't amount to anything. But at least you're happy doing this as opposed to something else that interests you even less, kind of thing. And of course, the subject seems quite intimidating, the Holocaust. But what's interesting is that it's gone from intimidating for one reason to intimidating for almost the opposite reason. I mean, if I had tried to do this 35 years ago or 30 years ago, you know, I would have been confronted with reviewers saying, quoting me Adorno and saying, there is no poetry after Auschwitz and no one can write about this. Mm-hmm. What's really been striking is the amount of response I've gotten that's been, well, given how flooded we are with Holocaust narratives, do we need one more Holocaust narrative? And then usually, happily, the reviewer turns and says, well, in this case, yes. But I'm struck by the notion that we've gone from no one can write about this to, boy, do we need any other people writing about this? And I think that transition has been almost entirely affected by Steven Spielberg and Schindler's List, essentially.
But you can't imagine a subject that is more worthy to be written about and to have a perspective.
Well, on the one hand, it's true. It's hard to imagine a more important subject than human-sponsored genocide, right? And a subject that's more of urgent moment for us. On the other hand, you, as you know from talking with readers and being a reader yourself, as soon as you say, this is the subject of my book, you don't have most readers' eyes light up with enthusiasm and say, well, that's just what I wanted to take to the beach, you know? So you have that to overcome. You have readers saying some version of, even literary readers saying some version of, do I really want to grapple with this much misery or this much pain or this much whatever? And some decide not to, and some say, well, I heard good things about it, I'll dip my toe in it. And, you know, but you know that you're facing that when you propose that subject to someone.
Because so much has been written, because of Schindler's List, because of the really the flooding, if you will, of a lot of different stories and narratives about the Holocaust, did that in any way affect your research?
I think what it did was it affected me exactly the way if I were writing about anything else that I thought had a large body of work out there, I would have to take it into account. And that is to say, there's an iconography, there's a series of archetypes, there's a series of patterns that you have to both take into account and continually either transform or defamiliarize in some ways, right? So that the reader doesn't think at any moment, oh, this is the same old story. I mean, on the one hand, you obviously need to include some of those patterns where the reader says, I don't even know why this is a Holocaust narrative. On the other hand, you need to defamiliarize nearly all of those things that readers, without even fully realizing it, have begun to see as a kind of iconography.
How soon did you know what you wanted to write about, of what you wanted the novel to be about?
I think pretty quickly I began to think a boy in the orphanage. I didn't have much of a sense of what the boy's history would be, except that he would have been very poor and come from the East. Once you decide that you're going to write about Korchak's orphanage, you know, that onrushing wall of what happened to everybody in the orphanage is heading towards you, which is one of the interesting aesthetic problems I always take on when I write about historical catastrophe, because on the one hand, the good news is some of your plot seems to be in place already, and then on the other hand, the bad news is some of your plot seems to be in place already, and you have the reader sort of saying, well, I think I know how this comes out. How is Jim going to in some ways surprise me or do something with this other than the inevitable thing that I see coming? And that inevitable thing seems interesting to me. It's interesting to me as a writer as I'm writing it, a little bit like, you know, poets talk about the usefulness of formal poetry as a sort of constraint that they work around. That seems useful to me as a writer, and I think it starts to become intriguing as a reader, too. I think the reader in a story like this starts to think, okay, well, where is this going? It seems like it can only go in one place, so how is he going to get out of this, essentially, an aesthetic problem?
And do you know that? Do you know how you're going to deal with the inevitable?
I don't, but although it's not an entirely unpleasant frisson as I'm heading farther and farther into the draft, I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, and in a case like this, you know, there might be some parameters set out by the nature of the subject. For example, I know when I'm very early in a project like this that I'm not going to take the reader all the way into Treblinka and dramatize that. I know that that seems to me too far down a certain aggressive path that I don't think the fiction is going to go. On the other hand, I also know that I can't stop much before that. So it would seem as though the boundaries are pretty narrow. But of course, as fiction writers figured out a long time ago, within very narrow boundaries, you have pretty much infinite possibility.
Jim Shepherd is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is The Book of Aaron. The voice of Aaron, you tell the story in the first person. Did Did that come quickly, or did you have to really work on that, of adopting that voice?
The notion of it came very quickly. I had to work on it very much in terms of refining it and refining it and refining it. Like a lot of writers I know, my process is I go back over the previous day's work before I move forward, and very often then don't get to move forward because I'm revising so much. And in the case of Aaron, almost all of that revision had to do with refining his voice and refining his voice and refining his voice. And I thought I had a fairly laconic and individuated voice when I began, but it began to become more and more clear to me as I went along, essentially. And so although the idea of a voice of a boy and that kind of voice was very early in the process, the voice itself wasn't finished until the book was finished. Really. Mm.
Is it the age or the circumstance or both that is the struggle or the concern?
It's pretty much all of that. And it's also trying very hard to render plausibly enough of a sense of another world that the reader never thinks, oh, this is a 21st century American boy who's supposed to be in the Warsaw Ghetto or something like that. So you're trying to render another class, you're trying to render another place, you're trying to render another ethnicity, but you're also trying to render those things that are universal to a child's, especially a traumatized child's experience. And so a lot of the revision might involve going back and saying, this diction doesn't seem exactly right, this diction seems a little too Anglophile, this diction seems whatever. Yeah.
I've always wondered about when novelists write about history and an historic time, place, that so many people respond to it by saying, well, it's as relevant now as it was
right
then. Do you in any way embrace that, avoid that?
To some extent, I think the historical novelist, if he's a literary or she's a literary novelist, has to embrace that, because the notion that it has no relevance to us today, then essentially evacuates it of any kind of thematic or emotional urgency. Fortunately, for those of us who write periodically about historical subjects, the species is so determined not to learn from history that we keep reiterating the things we've done before. And so the idea that something happened in the past and therefore why would we engage it is almost an idea we don't even have to deal with anymore. I mean, when I'm being interviewed or I'm doing a Q&A, people will immediately bring up genocides in other areas or, you know, prejudice or whatever, you know, other ways in which this story ramifies.
In writing, you mentioned early on about writing about a saint. At what point did you decide how you were going to deal with that and have this character interact with this boy that you've outlined?
Well, you teach yourself by going. My way in was to say to myself, so this boy is not at all reverent about the saint, and that'll help me initially. But of course, that wasn't going to get me all the way through the novel. And one of the other things that was a huge help was the more I began to research, the more I began to realize that I was catching Korczak really very much at the end of his life and at the end of his tether. He had been doing this for a long, long time. He was in his early 60s, middle 60s, and his health was in tatters. And the idea that he would be pretty close to despairing even as an idealist and pretty close to selfish even as a selfless figure began to emerge very powerfully. You know, one of the things that I taught myself by going back over the materials was the way in which one of the other aspects of saintly dedication is a kind of messianic singularity of focus. And so if you're the unhappy figure that happens to be needing something emotionally from the messianic figure, you're kind of out of luck, because the messianic figure will say, you know what, Joe, I don't even take care of myself, so I'm certainly not going to be taking care of you. And that immediately brought an interesting complexity to Korczak's character, because when people need him individually, when they say, you know, I really could use some bucking up here, he very often by the end was sort of saying, look, you know, times are tough all over, you know, let's just see if we can hold it together till tomorrow.
Yeah. His backstory is fascinating. Mm-hmm. The range and the depth of that background is fascinating. He did a lot of things.
He was a Renaissance figure, really a dramatic Renaissance figure. And that was also part of what I was then able to neatly sidestep by doing a child's protagonist, because there were a huge number of aspects to his life that I wanted to only allude to and not dramatize. You know, he was a hugely important educational reformer, for example, and I didn't want to give the history of his educational reform. But if I'm inside his head, you know, there's all sorts of ways in which he'll be drawing on all that information. But if I'm inside the head of someone who's around him a lot of the time, the outlines of the nature of that educational reform can become clear. There can be references to the educational reform, but I don't have to dramatize the whole arc of it by any means of his career, you know.
The book is relatively short. Was that always your intention?
I think so. When I begin a project, I don't know whether it's a novel or a story. And in this case, what I did was I sort of laid out what I imagined would be the main events and the main arc of the boy's narrative, and thought, well, how long, what's the maximum number of pages that it would take me to do this? And once I got to around 70 or 80 pages, I thought, okay, well, this is going to be a short novel rather than a long story. I'm often, as you know, more drawn to stories because they put less food on my children's plates.
By design?
By design.
By design.
Keep them lean and hungry.
In writing a novel like this, is the point when it's over, how long does it stay with you, and does it impact what you do next?
That's a good question. Not that the other ones weren't good questions too, Joe.
Thank you,
Joe. Yeah. But, you know, it's hard to know to what extent it stays with you. I know that one of the odd things about this book has been that I've had a much longer book tour than I normally do, which meant that whether it stayed with me or not, it was forcibly brought back into my consciousness, because day after day I would be talking about it and being interviewed about it and things like that. And what's odd about that in even more extended ways that the ordinary reader sometimes might lose sight of is usually you've delivered a book close to a year before the book comes out. So this is something that I more or less wanted to stop thinking about maybe the January before this January, so January of whatever. So it's been a long time since I wanted to be immersed in this material, because it's not so much that it's emotionally costly, although there's a little bit of that. You are both empathetically invested in it and, of course, the detached aesthetic figure who's manipulating all this stuff, neither of which is a very pleasant position. But also you just want to get on to the next thing. And in my case, I'm usually doing something radically different than the thing I did before. So to have this material come back is oddly distracting, because it's not as though, you know, the next story is the Holocaust sequel or something like that.
But given your penchant for catastrophe, this will be an awkward question. But then it is. Do you sense, well, how am I going to top that?
Right. No, I don't think of myself as simply coming up with one catastrophe that's bigger than the other one.
Right.
And in fact, some subjects seem to me more ambitious than others, and might have a much smaller scope. You know, I had a story in an earlier collection that was narrated by the manservant of a 15th century French nobleman who was a serial killer. And that seemed to me more of an empathetic stretch and more of an ambitious thing than this in some ways, because it felt to me more impossible to try and pull off. So to a reader, the reader might go, well, this is a more difficult thing to top. But to me, it's a matter of how far am I trying to stretch my empathetic imagination.
And you mentioned the word scope, but I guess that puts into my mind that it is... it's how deep you want to go. It's not so much the subject matter as it is
the
scope. Yeah,
I think that's right. And of course, when you choose a child to narrate your Holocaust novel, you're playing with scope all the time, right? Because the Holocaust seems to call out for the largest possible scope. The reader brings to it the notion that 6 million people died. But then you keep cranking it down and up again if you have one child running around the streets, as opposed to an omniscient narration that's tracking great masses of people, you know.
The new book is The Book of Aaron. It is published by Knopf. Jim Shepherd, always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark is for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.